Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And we're about to shatter some myths here in this interview. The first myth is that if you're going to be a startup entrepreneur, you need to be a software entrepreneur. Today's guest sells meat. Meat, a product that's existed and that people have consumed about as long as humans have been around. That's what he's selling, and wait till you find out how well he's doing with it. The second myth is that you have to raise money. He's done it. And he has some pretty strong opinions about what happens when you raise money and about why you probably don't want to raise money. And the third myth is about, you know, the inner part of the entrepreneur. We think that that doesn't matter. Today's guest went through a period there where I think a lot of other people would have doubted themselves much more than he did, where he needed to build up his inner strength in order to start his company. He did it. I want to find out how. I want to find out how he did this whole thing. Meat, guys. Meat. He's selling meat online. Wait till you find out how well he's doing with it. All right. His name is Michael Salguero. He is the founder of ButcherBox. ButcherBox delivers grass-fed, and we'll find out why that matters, grass-fed, antibiotic, and hormone-free meat to your door. And I want to find out how he can do that. I don't think you could just put that in a UPS mail pouch and get it out. That was an issue, and he figured it out. This whole thing is sponsored by two great companies. The first is one that Michael might actually want to sign up for. It's called Active Campaign. I'll tell you about how it'll help improve your email marketing. And the second is the software that we use to close more sales. It's called Pipe Drive. I'll tell you more about both those later. First, Michael, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, I want to kind of go back a little bit further in your history than what we're working on right now. And go back to the time when you were 10 years old. Your mom was a single mom, and she told you to do what to if you wanted money?
Oh, get a job.
Get a job at 10.
Yeah. Yeah, 10. I had a paper route when I was 10 years old. So it was a daily paper every day except for Saturday. So mm-hmm. I'd be out there delivering papers. I think I had 35 on my route. So at a very early age, I was the youngest of four, single mother. And at a very early age, I was told I'd have to do it myself if I wanted money or if I wanted to do fun things. So, obviously I had a great upbringing. My mom was amazing. But definitely work ethic was instilled in me very early on.
And then you created a t-shirt that said what on the front?
you got some good data. So it said Buck Fush. So you can figure out what that means. So this was 2004. George Bush versus John Kerry. And this t-shirt, I was working full time as a real estate guy and a sales guy, and just created this t-shirt on a whim, and it just took off. So we sold 17,000 t-shirts in 3 months, and went all around the country, had a big sales force of people. And this was kind of like pre-internet. The internet was around, but it wasn't like internet distribution was a big thing.
A sales force for selling anti-George Bush t-shirts?
Yeah.
Wow. And where were they selling?
Where?
Yeah.
All over. I mean, the biggest seller was we were in New York for the RNC, and there were all these like protests and all this stuff. So we were just in the heat of that. And at the time it wasn't necessarily a big passion, but I was really into creating movements and creating these icons or brands that people wanted to wear and move on. So I always loved t-shirts because you can. You could see them just like out there in the world, and it's pretty cool.
Just to be clear, it said Buck Fush, which is kind of a play on, what you wanted, what they wanted to do to George Bush.
Right. Yes.
Okay. And what year was this?
That was 2004.
2004. Okay. So as I understand it, you're a guy who was going to take, who was in business classes. You were listening to professors who were telling you, hey, if you really want to make it in this world, the first thing you need to do is get an internship at a company like Morgan Stanley. Once you do that, then you build yourself up. And you're going down this path going, something, I know I had a paper route. I was working since 10. Something doesn't feel right here. And then boom, you sell these t-shirts. They hit and you realize, you know what? This inner thing that I had inside me, this entrepreneurial spirit, it's not wrong. My teachers, my professors who were sending me in the other direction didn't get it. Now you've got the bug. Now you decide I'm going to start something. As I understand it, I read this Inc. magazine article about you. You then bought a domain in a company called CustomMade.com, right? For $150,000, am I right?
Yeah. Well, there's a short stint where I doubted myself as an entrepreneur and decided to go get a white collar job. So I took me 6 months to find a job in real estate. But I spent 2.5 years working for the man, hating every minute of it, But it was all about confidence. It was like I didn't have the confidence to actually go for it on my dream. So
Why not? I love that you're open about this, and I'm hoping later on as we talk about what happened with Custom Made that you'll continue to be open. But I'm wondering why. Why didn't you why did you still doubt yourself, even though you're a guy who sold T-shirts? If we go back in your history, we know that even in your childhood at one point you sold other T-shirts that said the word Boston on them. What was it about you, even though you did all this, that made you think, I'm not really an entrepreneur. I'm not one of those guys.
You know, honestly, I think part of it is just that the world was a little different. It was a little less friendly to the entrepreneur back in, what was it, 2006. So there weren't like the incubators and the, you know, mentorship and the blogs and all this stuff to like read and be like, oh yeah, I'm on the path of being an entrepreneur. I was out of school and yeah, I'd been successful with a t-shirt, but yeah, if you're talking to my mother, it's like, yeah, I'm going to go sell t-shirts. It's like, okay, why don't you go get a job? You know, like, so it wasn't something, I didn't have the confidence that like, oh, I'm really building something towards the future, even though I was very confident in my ideas. I was able to bring in a, you know, a slug of money. It was, but I just didn't, I felt like I needed more time working for other people.
I see. Kind of like pay your dues and all that. And again, this is before, Paul Graham went out and started talking and recruiting entrepreneurs. This is before there was a startup ecosystem. Okay. And so then,
but now in those same classes, they're probably telling you like not to go get an internship. Right. Stanley, but to like, you know, go start something over the summer. So it, a lot has changed in the past 10 years. The focus from you haven't made it in business unless you're working in, you know, finance, to you haven't made it in business unless you're starting your own company, has been a huge change in the dialogue.
I love how dogmatic people are too. It's always, you have to, here's the path. You have to now be an entrepreneur, or right. Before it was, you have to get a job and be an intern first. Okay. So then I'm wondering, what was it about custommade.com that drew you to it? I'm looking at an early version of the site. This was a site made for, your source for all things custom made. You're probably here because, like us, you realize that the best place to get unique furniture, cabinetry, and specialty items is directly from the artisans that created them. What was it about that statement that I'm reading on the homepage? You're smiling as I read that said, this is us. This is what we need to do.
Is that like the Wayback Machine?
Yeah, man.
Yeah, so you're looking at like, well, yeah. So, super ugly website. Built in 1996 by a woodworker who built it to show off his stuff. And then he had friends, early internet, his friends were like, oh, can you put my stuff on there as well? And so it was a really interesting, about 400 woodworkers from across the United States and Canada. And when you talk to these guys, they're like, I get all my business from that website and I pay $35 a year for a subscription. And my buddy and I, we were best friends, and we were looking to do something together and had looked at a whole bunch of different ideas. And he was buying a custom coffee table and was like, why don't we just buy this? So we approached the seller, and the idea was, we called it a shack in Manhattan. So the idea was that you have all these people who are just getting huge value from this website and they're paying $35 a year. How about we purchase the website? By the way, no technology experience whatsoever. Let's purchase the website. Let's reskin it, and then let's jack up the rents. That was like basically the whole investment thesis.
I see. That makes sense, though.
Pretty simple. It was pretty simple. And so we had no money, or minimal money. We put down a $5,000 deposit, which we split, and then we did our letter of intent was a 90-day due diligence period. And within those 90 days, we went out and raised $140,000 to purchase the website. So basically risked $5,000 and then went and raised the rest with a logo on a BlackBerry, because BlackBerries were a thing back then. And this was 2008. So this is right when the whole world was collapsing financially. Lots of people in Boston, a lot of the wealthy families of Boston lost their shirt with Bernie Madoff. So it was just like a bloodbath out there, and we were out there trying to convince people to give money to two people who didn't even know how to, you know, do anything on a website. But we had this vision for this play where we were going to be able to add a lot more woodworkers and grow something really big. So that business we started with money, and we started with not with your traditional VCs or angels, or it was just like regular people who are willing to write $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 checks. Mm-hmm. Ended up raising 500 grand. I think there were like 40 people involved.
Wow.
Got told no a lot before we were able to raise all that money.
So I did a fast forward on the Internet Archive, and you really did improve the look of the site. It went from looking like a homemade site to one that was a little more professional. We're still not at Etsy level, but Etsy is the kind of feel that you're going for and the kind of artisan that you're recruiting would be today maybe on Etsy. And so things are coming together.
Yep.
And still, there was a challenge, something that made you go back and reconsider the whole business. What happened?
We got on the raising money train very early because we weren't really able to start it without raising money and purchasing the domain. And then we raised a little bit more. So we raised 500 and then we raised 1.1 and we're still building out a subscription business. So the whole idea was in 1996, you had to go through a webmaster to get your content up on the web. But, hey, this is 2009. You can actually log in and manage your own content and whatnot.
Yep.
So we built out a big subscription business where we had, I don't know, 12 phone salespeople, and we're just kind of like selling subscriptions. I think the top subscription package was like $700, and it was an interesting business. I mean, it was we were probably doing $2 or $3 million a year, which is fine. It was certainly not a huge business. Would have been great. Would have cash flowed well. It was cash flowing well. And then we decided that we wanted to, like, you know, hit it big, go big time. And so we decided to go raise money, go raise a lot of money. And we went around, and nobody wanted to invest in a maker-based or, you know, a woodworker-focused subscription business. People are like, that's boring. That's not going to scale. How big is woodworking in the U.S.? Like, you know, all the typical complaints that you hear or issues that you hear. So we ended up, like, literally after being told no, like, 60 times throughout the whole summer, one investor was like, I said to this investor, I was like, well, actually, I'll take a step back. So we had this thing on our website called the job board, which was the biggest question we got from potential subscribers was, well, how do I know that people are actually looking for jobs here? And so we built out this board that would, like, publicly post them.
Yes.
And basically, we went to an investor, and in the meeting, I'm showing this job board, and I'm like, you know, all we have to do is just stand in between these transactions and take a fee, and we have a huge marketplace on our hand.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I said marketplace, like, the whole conversation changed. This is right around the time, it's like 2010, right around the time where Airbnb was starting to scale up. And people were just, like, so fired up about this notion of a marketplace and the notion that we're, like, two-sided and could, like, stand in between. And then just money just started, like, getting poured on us. So
I see, because the thing that investors started to feel about marketplaces, at first it was marketplaces are too hard because you have to go after two different groups of people and so on. Then they realize, you know what, if you make it work, then you have a moat because no kid in his garage can create a marketplace on his own. And
right.
So I see. So that was the attraction. And I noticed that even in my interviews, that suddenly marketplaces were getting more funding, more excitement. People who ran marketplaces held themselves higher, where before it was, I just run a marketplace. I don't really do anything. It was, I run a marketplace.
Yeah.
And so I could see then you raised money from First Round Capital, which from what I've seen is one of the best investors because they're so supportive, right?
Yep.
Atlas Venture, Google Ventures backed you guys. You raised a total of how much money?
So we raised, in total, we raised $28 million over five rounds of financing. So we raised $1.9 from Google in First Round and Founder Collective and a few others, but those are the big ones. And they were really the ones who were, like, early supporters of this notion of pivot to a marketplace. And then we did that, and then, you know, things were great. So then 6 months later, another $4 million got dumped in from them, as well as another lead investor. And then a year later, $18 million got dumped in.
Wait, weren't you a marketplace in the beginning? Wasn't it? It was this guy, Ted, who ran the site. Am I right? He came up with the idea, and then Ted started to sell his own stuff, and then his friends sold their stuff. Isn't that a marketplace?
It wasn't really. It was more like a Yellow Pages with a portfolio. So you can
I see.
Weren't selling anything. You weren't like actually actively selling.
They were paying to list themselves. So if someone like me wanted to buy new handmade furniture, I could go and see it. Got it. So you're saying suddenly
contact, and then we'd send an email that said, this is a lead from Custom Made, and then, you know, you would you'd write to them. So we were trying to, like, we were always trying to convince people of our value and try to tell them it's worth the $200 for them to have a subscription.
Okay.
Of course, their biggest concern is, like, well, did I actually get any value? And, you know, you're always trying to sell your value.
Okay. Meanwhile, though, because you raised so much money, you told our producer, I don't know if you remember saying this, but you said, we had so much money. I remember one time looking at this team of developers that we had, the tech team. Do you remember what I'm talking about? What did you see them do?
Yeah. So I went up to one of my engineers and I'm like, dude, like every time I pass your desk, you're playing video games. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're supposed to be working. This is work. And he's like, no, I'm not playing video games. I'm watching people play video games. It was like, oh my God, what does this come to? Yeah, so we had like 16 engineers, no idea what anyone was working on. Because, I mean, really, and we'll probably talk about this later, but after much reflection on like what happened, what went wrong, we didn't have product market fit. So the marketplace that we had built was, it was a really great tool for a customer to describe exactly what they want and meet a maker who could make it. And facilitate the conversation online. The challenge is you have customers who don't know how to describe what they're looking for. So they're like, I don't know. I really need to like talk about it. And then you have makers who, a lot of these people like didn't graduate from high school or didn't graduate from college and don't write very well and are introverted and don't sell. And now you're asking them to like do all their sales online, and to do it like on a computer screen. So you just imagine the form factor of like your shop. You have sawdust all over the place and you're trying to like get on your laptop to like respond to a potential customer. It didn't work. Like custom doing a back and forth transaction online and us being in between, but not being in between. It didn't work.
So then that's the hard reset.
Money, and we had convinced so many people that the marketplace was going to change the world that, you know, there was like no return. There was no going back. It wasn't like, oh, actually this didn't work, so let's do something different. It was like, yeah, we're gonna build a marketplace. And, you know, the number one thing to do when you're building a big marketplace is to build a big technology team and build a big product team and a big design team, even if like they weren't necessarily doing anything.
Okay, so you and your co-founder decided we have to change everything. We have to take drastic steps to adjust. And I could see it. Anyone who goes today to custommade.com is going to see not furniture, not a list of artisans who could make your next coffee table, but jewelry. Custom-made jewelry is front and center on the site now. Why don't we take a moment to talk about our sponsor? And then I want to come back and say, in that little period where you guys were trying to figure out what to do, you personally had this little idea that, frankly, if you came to me and said, Andrew, can I raise money from you for this idea? I would have said, dude, this is never going to work. It's going to be too small. And still, even as I read, I had to read so many times how well you were doing with this to make sure this is real. I went back to your website. I said, it's amazing. All right. First, let me tell everyone about my first of two sponsors. The first sponsor is a company called Pipe Drive. Mike, let me tell you, here's an issue that you might as a salesperson identify with. Do you ever do any sales one-on-one?
Yes.
I do. Do you get in your own head? Are you good at it?
I think I'm pretty good at it. Decent.
What makes you good at it?
Personal connection.
Ah. So here's the thing that I found. A lot of people don't have personal connection and they're not especially good when they're starting about building that rapport fast. And what it takes to really sell for them is doing it often. The problem is they send one or two emails out, no one buys, and they think I've done something wrong, and they procrastinate, they get in their own heads, and they think they're not good. Here's a trick that I've heard from one of my past interviewees. When he was starting out in sales, he put a stack of quarters on the left side of his desk. Every time he made a phone call, he moved one of those quarters to the right. He would not get his butt off the seat until he moved all the quarters. And at the end, he became, first of all, he closed more sales because even if you suck, it's a numbers game. You can close some sales. But he also became a better salesperson. So this is one of the reasons why I advocate Pipedrive. One of the things that Pipedrive will do for anyone who's listening to me right now is it will give you that virtual stack of quarters. It'll say, here's how many people you reached out to today, this week, this year. That's phenomenally helpful. When you're sitting down and thinking, I'm not very good, or maybe there's something wrong with the way I'm doing it, to look at your stats and realize, You only sent out two this week. We'll tell you, it's not you. You're not doing enough. It's that you're not moving. Get out there. Here's the second thing it does. I've talked to so many entrepreneurs. They're really good at selling. I'm thinking about the founder of, what's the affiliate company? I can't think of them right now. Oh, Ambassador. Founder of Ambassador is a good salesperson, maybe like you, in his gut. Are you like naturally a good salesperson?
I think so.
Yeah, he was too. The thing is that in his gut, he could sell, but he couldn't tell other people here's how to sell because he couldn't hand his gut out of his stomach and put it in their hands. Well, you know, out of his, whatever, not stomach, but gut is underneath the stomach, right? He couldn't give it to them. So then he finally hired someone who was a VP of sales who said, dude, your gut is not helping us get to the next level. It got us here. It's not going to get us there. What I need is a structure for sales. And so he started laying out a structure. Well, what Pipedrive does is it forces anyone who's using the software to lay out their structure. What's a step-by-step process for closing a sale? So now you know how many people you're getting in your Pipedrive, in your pipeline, and how many steps there are to closing a sale. And because it gives you stats on how many people you've asked to buy, how many people you closed, where you lost them. You also know what part of your sales process feels good to you, but is actually not helping your sales. All right. Anyone out there who is in sales at all should understand these problems and should understand that this is going to help you as an individual, but you should also know that as you add people to your team, each one of them can own a part of this pipeline and work together. I'm using the word pipeline and pipe drive interchangeably. I don't want to be confusing at all. This is pipe as in the thing that's going to hit you in the knee. Why don't we go with that? Whatever. Pipe and drive because you're going to drive more sales with this. Go to pipedrive.com/mixergy. You're going to get 14 days free. You're going to get 25% off for your first 3 months after that. Frankly, within that period, you're going to see that this will help your sales. Do it. Be disciplined about it. Frankly, you got to want to grow your business. And there's only one part that can really bring in money for your business and allow you to grow, right? It doesn't have to be VC. Even if you get VC money like Mike did at one point, ultimately, it's got to come from your customers, and Pipedrive is going to help it come from your customers. Go to pipedrive.com/mixergy. All right. In that period, you were thinking, Mike, you know what? I got to get healthier. And so to get healthier, what did you do for yourself? This will give me a sense of why you wanted me to emphasize grass-fed. I actually wasn't even going to say grass-fed about your business, but it was a part of what you were trying to do for your health. Tell me about what you did.
Yeah, sure. So it actually really started with my wife. So my wife has a thyroid problem where her thyroid, she has hypothyroidism. So she takes like a medicine every day, and a lot of people have it. But anyway, so one of the things that you can do, it's an inflammatory disease. One of the things you can do is try to de-inflame your body. And so we started following all these diets, and I just went along for the ride because I like to, you know, try to lose weight and be healthy and whatnot. And the first thing we did was a whole 30 diet, and then we followed paleo diet, and then we followed elimination diets, and we were like trying a whole bunch of different stuff. And she's now gluten and dairy free, and all these diets specifically said eat grass-fed beef. And you know, I knew nothing about grass-fed beef. I'm actually half Uruguayan, which is like one of the capitals of grass-fed, but it wasn't something that I like prioritized or thought about. We started looking like, oh, okay, let's get some grass-fed beef. And it turns out it's like not in your local grocery store. It certainly wasn't in our local grocery store. And I started doing more research and found a few farms online, but it was incredibly expensive. It was like you could fill your basket, your cart, and then it was like $50 to ship it. So that wasn't going to work. And then one of my friends, his father-in-law has a farm in New York, and he started doing what's called a cow share, which is essentially you get an eighth of a cow, mm-hmm. Which is about two trash bags full of meat. And he would buy it from his father-in-law, drive it from New York or from Albany all the way to Boston, put it out in his living room, and you'd buy like an eighth of a cow, which was two trash bags, and bring it home. I did that once, and meat was fantastic, and it was too much for my small apartment, so I started sharing the steaks with friends because I like had too many. It was like, I'm not going to eat all this meat, so let me share some with you and share some with you. 6 months later, needed more, went back to him. This time, instead of getting an eighth of a cow, I got half a cow because the same friends that I had given steaks to were like, oh, next time you go, they'd let me know. And the final time, I bought a whole cow. And as the Inc. article says, I split it up like a drug dealer and sold it on the floor. And one of the guys who actually worked for me at the time at Custom Made was like, this would be so much better if I could just have it delivered to my house. And I was like, that's interesting. And at the time, I knew I was leaving Custom Made. So my co-founder and I we were having a lot of trouble with our investors. Basically, we went like product market fit, and then we were trying to figure it out. And it turned out it wasn't working. So whose fault is it? It's definitely our fault. So, you know, they were out gunning for our heads. My co-founder had become the CEO, so I was the CEO, and then he was, and I was bored. I was just like done, looking for something else to do, at least a hobby to get into, and I was looking for subscription businesses because when we were a subscription business at Custom Made, it was great because subscription just keeps coming in. You just keep rolling in, so if you can do a sale, you can keep that sale going, and so that was really exciting for me for, you know, so I started thinking about this concept of, hey, could we deliver meat, grass-fed beef, to your door on a monthly basis? And I had this idea. It was like a bug in my head, and I just couldn't get it out, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. So I didn't know how to ship it. I didn't know how to procure it. I didn't know how to get the cut. It seemed like a really great idea, but I had no idea how to put the pieces together. And I ended up meeting the former head of operations of Omaha Steaks.
Because you went out of your way. You said, I have to solve this freaking puzzle. Yeah. You went to LinkedIn, and in one of the best uses of LinkedIn, you actually found the guy who did this for Omaha Steaks because they ship it all over. You contacted him. You said, can I talk to you? He said, here's how we did it. And he opened your eyes. How do you do that? How do you ship steak?
Well, very carefully is the answer. So Omaha Steaks and us were similar in terms of we ship steak frozen and pre-portioned in the mail. They do like a styrofoam cooler. We don't do that. But, you know, when we started, we did. And essentially, you can work with these frozen fulfillment houses that ship things frozen. You get it cut from different cutters, and you have to procure it from certain farms. And then it gets cut into 10-ounce portion or whatever you're doing. And then you ship it out. And we ship with dry ice. It's about 5 pounds of dry ice per day in transit. So you just load that thing up with dry ice and put it out on UPS or FedEx. And I mean, the amazing part of the model is that literally we can get a box of meat anywhere in the country. So a lot of the people that we deal with are might be in the middle of nowhere and following some diet or for whatever reason are trying to clean up the meat that they're eating. And there are lots of different reasons, usually health, caring about the environment, caring about the animal. But they, for whatever reason, they've made that choice and they can't find it. Like, it's just not in their grocery store. So our ability to ship directly to that customer, regardless of where they are, is a pretty powerful thing.
And that was the first thing that you did. You didn't start by going door to door in, where were you at the time? New York?
Boston.
Boston. You weren't actually taking it door to door in Boston. You started from the beginning with a frozen fulfillment house. You know what? Did you even need that guy then from Omaha Steak? Once he told you that there's a frozen fulfillment house, why did you even need to work with him? Couldn't you just say, thanks for the piece of information, I'll go find one and I'll work with them and they'll ship it out for me?
Yeah,
why couldn't you do that?
Pretty much. I mean, at this point, he doesn't really do much.
I see. So once he got you started with them...
he got us started and then kind of like let us free, right? So
got it.
We use different people than he introduced us to. We use different fulfillment houses. I mean, our whole system is...
It was just opening your eyes to the fact that you don't have to ship it from your house. You don't have to ship it from the ranch. There are people who have the infrastructure in place. Got it. Okay.
So he had the connections, right? Because I'm some, you know, guy who knows nothing about meat, trying to get involved in meat. So when you go and talk to a frozen fulfillment house, they're not really that excited about working with you. So, you know, when I started and went to these guys, like, okay, look, we're going to start a Kickstarter, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And I think it's going to be really successful. Like, you know, they're like, okay, we don't even know what Kickstarter is. And who is this guy? You're not going to sell product. You think you are, but you're not going to.
That's what he was saying about you, but he might as well give you a little bit of advice because he was in the space.
Right.
Like, you know what? I don't eat meat anymore, but when I was living in Argentina, I did eat grass-fed beef, and I remember the taste is different. It takes a little getting used to because it is so clean, so pure, so much better than the stuff that you're used to. It's like if you drink poison, a little bit of poison every day, you start to think that everything needs to taste that way. When you get rid of it, whatever you're tasting feels a little weird. I could have gone with something better. You know what a better analogy was? When I was a kid, I would drink tea with 3 teaspoons of sugar in it all the time. The first time I drank tea with no sugar, I thought there's something weird with the tea. Eventually, after a few times of drinking it, I realized I don't need all that sugar. It's just not necessary. Same thing here. I totally get not the environmental part of it or the health benefits of it. I just have no connection to it. But the taste blew my mind when I moved to Argentina and I had it. So I told you that if you came to me with this idea, I would say it's never going to be huge. But the truth is, not only was I wrong, you didn't walk into this thinking it was going to be huge. You told our producer, my goal was to sell how many?
I there's an article somewhere that said, I got interviewed and I said, if we get to 1,000 subscribers, this is a really sexy business.
Right. 1,000 subscribers at how much a month?
It's $129 a month.
Okay. So that would end up with... Sorry?
That would have been a $1.5 million company with... low expenses, and really what I was thinking was this was going to be kind of my hobby business or my side hustle while I went and like figured out what the next big thing was.
So let's talk about the inner entrepreneur, because I love that you're open about this stuff. We all go through it. It's hard to get people who are in touch enough with it. You are going through a thing. You were thinking, I am not... Here's what you told our producer, and I highlighted it. You said, I was dealing with a lot of head trash around being a failure. Expand on that. What was going on in your head that kept you from seeing this for the big opportunity that it was, kept you from seeing who you were and your potential as an entrepreneur?
Yeah. So, I mean, I basically just driven around, right? So we raised $27 million to $28 million. My co-founder took over, but we took the team from 50 people to 6, laid everybody off, closed up shop really quickly. And it wasn't the outcome. It certainly wasn't the outcome that I sold all these investors on. It wasn't the outcome that I sold myself on that was going to happen. And I don't know. I mean, you know, one of the challenges of being an entrepreneur, especially if you're a venture backed entrepreneur, is you're always like the only thing that you compare yourself to is the exit. Like, that's it. You know, it's like, never mind the millions of dollars of impact that we had on all these makers and all these people who work for us, whose careers have just blossomed since they work for us. That doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is like how much did you sell for and how much did you drive a value for your investors. At least that's what I thought.
Well, isn't that right though? I think you were right in thinking that. That's what they're looking for. They might say, hey, I'm looking to get to know you for your next venture, for your next company. But the truth is they have a need too.
Yeah, sure. They got, you know, they got pension funds and life insurance companies and people who require a return, who are expecting to get a return on their investment.
Yeah. And you knew them personally. They were in the trenches with you. It's really hard to let someone down when they believe in you to that degree, right?
Sure.
And so were you depressed about it? Did you have a hard time thinking it through? What was it?
I wouldn't say I was depressed about it. I mean, I didn't really skip a beat, to be honest. So my plan was to leave Custom Made, take 100 days off, and then start something else. By the time that Custom Made was coming to an end, I had already put all these pieces together. So I took the weekend off. And then started ButcherBox. Literally took 3 days off. I'm not very good at like dwelling on, I don't know if I should be, but dwelling on mistakes or dwelling on like things that I wish I did differently. There is a ton of regret. There's a ton of like conversations I wish I had differently, people who we let go, who I wish we took a chance on, situations where I wish I, you know, said something different or did something different, or even just like, you know, we didn't need to raise all that money. Like I know it was there. I know people were like, here's some more money, but we didn't need to. And, sure, I regret all that. But, the biggest piece of head trash, like when we started, and I would be honest, I'd say it's still there. I certainly don't think I'm like, oh wow, this is like an amazing success. I have a huge chip on my shoulder to build something big and enduring and kind of do it my own way. And that continues to be my chip, the thing that I'm...
It kind of feels like you have. All right, so then the first thing we did was you did Kickstarter. Why do Kickstarter as opposed to something else?
The main reason, honestly, was... So I had spent all this time in marketplaces because I had just built a marketplace. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happens in marketplaces is there's a brief moment in time in any marketplace that's reached liquidity where there's a, basically the risk and reward is like way out of whack, meaning you can risk relatively little amount of money and get a really big reward. And I wanted to learn about that on Kickstarter while creating a project. So the thinking was I'll put $10,000 into this project. Worst case scenario, nobody wants to purchase this, and I just spent 10 grand learning about this different marketplace and really like getting the inner workings of it. But my hunch was that it was gameable, meaning like you could figure out a way to set up your campaign and do things in a way that was just going to have a tremendous amount of value or a tremendous amount of reward for the
relative. Oh, I see. You were thinking the Kickstarter crowdfunding marketplace is gameable. If you could get into it in 2015, which is when you were doing this, then you could understand what it takes to create something like this and where like the opportunities were. You didn't see opportunities in beef. You saw opportunities in crowdfunding marketplaces.
Well, I did see opportunities in the product that we were doing, but I thought it was going to be a fairly small opportunity. But I did see knowing how to utilize Kickstarter in particular, not necessarily building my own crowdfunding platform, but knowing how to use that crowdfunding platform to push something to huge.
I see.
The best thing that I've been able to equate it to is, I don't know if you remember this, but 10 years ago, there were all these stores out there where they will sell your stuff on eBay.
Right.
It used to be like in every strip mall, there was like, sell your stuff on eBay. And all that was somebody knew how to keyword stuff something and take good photos of something and mm-hmm. like turn and, you know, sell a trinket for $100. Whereas mm-hmm. if you did it, you would only sell it for $50. They knew the rules, right? And then over time, eBay's made it so darn easy to post it yourself, and they guide you through that process that you don't really need that intermediary anymore. So those people don't exist anymore. So Kickstarter is basically, and it still is, at a point where if you know the rules and you're able to play the playbook, you are able to have outsized returns compared to everybody else.
Got it. Okay.
And so I wanted to learn that, and I wanted to test and see if there was actually a market for grass-fed beef before we, like, you know, I don't know, before I started the whole thing. And
so there are two things that strike me about it. If you see my eyes darting everywhere, it's because whatever you're saying, I'm looking up. I want to see it. I don't just want to hear you say it. I want to understand it better so I can ask follow-up questions and to go deeper. The first thing that I'm wondering is the Kickstarter campaign was a one-time sale. If you were trying to do something on a subscription basis, it doesn't feel like you were getting the subscription there. Am I right?
Yeah. Well, they don't let you do a subscription on Kickstarter. So we did a one-time sale, but we also did 3 month, 6 month, and 12 month. But most of the people who came in were one time, and then we had to call each of them individually and try to get them to sign up for an offer.
I see. And by we, was it you calling them up? And
no, I brought in some you know, $12 an hour guy
who was calling them up.
Yep.
The other thing is, at one point, the site was redirecting to the organicbutcherofmclean.com.
Yeah.
What is that?
That is the guy who owned ButcherBox.com. So when we launched, we were GetButcherBox.com. I had reached out to him before I started saying, hey, I'd love to purchase your domain name. And he was like, well, I don't know. I really have all these ideas of what to do. And, you know, I want to do something online and blah, blah, blah. It was a pretty bad negotiation tactic. He told me his price. I forget what it was. It was like, he's like, I don't know. You're not going to like this price, but I think it's like $2,000 or something. And I was like, okay, cool. Let's do it. And he's like, no, hold on. Never mind. Let me get back to you. Basically I just kept hounding him, and a year later he sold. So
I
the
see.
First year we were GetButcherBox.com, and then we became ButcherBox.com.
Okay. All right. I want to talk about my second sponsor. I think you're going to benefit from them because I know what you're using for email marketing. And then I want to come back and talk about, for anyone who's listening, who's got goals. We always ask guests about the goals that they had. I've never had anyone tell me that they did this with their goals, and how it helped you hit your goals is really interesting. First, I got to tell everyone, my sponsor is a company called ActiveCampaign. You use one of their competitors for email. What kind of email marketing do you do, Mike?
We do a lot. We rely heavily on email, whether it's for potential customers or our current customers and trying to get them to purchase more or just understand how to cook their product. We do a tremendous amount of email marketing.
Yeah, and I hunted around. I saw that you guys use, screw it, I'm going to talk about competitors. You guys use SumoMe for collecting email addresses. That's not the competitor. You use MailChimp for sending out email. You also use a couple of other tools for sending out email. The thing that that strikes me is this. You do, when someone buys, start to send them into a second list as a buyer list, right?
Yep.
Here's what ActiveCampaign does to take that to the next step. Imagine if somebody is looking over and over at, where is that? Do you guys do a gift option?
Yep.
Right? So imagine if I wasn't looking at the order now page, but I kept looking at the gift page. At that point, you might know Andrew is not necessarily interested in buying it for himself. Let's add him to a sequence of messages that we send out to people who want to buy gifts, with maybe a picture of someone who got a gift, a story of someone who gave the gift and the benefit, and a third message about why this is the right gift to give to anyone and how their recipient is going to be treated. With the other email providers, you can't do that easily. What ActiveCampaign said was, this is something that top marketers do that is so overwhelming that they either have to hire a specialist to manage their email marketing, or the founder in many cases will just do it themselves because he geeks out on the software. He said, no, we have to come up with software that makes this easy and approachable for anyone. So for you or anyone who's listening to me, we all have parts of our website that people might maybe visit over and over again. Maybe it's a specific blog post that they're all migrating to. Maybe it's an offer that they keep seeing over and over. Anyone who sees that blog post, anyone who sees that that part of your site should be tagged. And maybe you send a sequence of messages based on that. That's the idea behind ActiveCampaign. Smart email marketing that's automated based on what people have done. And I'm giving you one example, what they've done on your website, but it could also be what they're doing with an email. So if someone keeps clicking the same thing over and over again, you might be aware that they're expressing an interest, not actively, but passively, that your software should take into account. Now, ActiveCampaign is doing, I mean, we're not talking about something that is mind-blowingly new. What they're doing is what bigger marketers have done forever and keeping it so simple that anyone can do it today. And I mean you, the person who's listening to me, can do it today. You can play around with it and then you can pass it on to your team and have them do it and make sure that it keeps getting handled right because it's easy and effective email marketing. If you guys are listening to me and you want to try this out, I'm going to give you something. First of all, you can try it for free right now by going to a URL that I'm going to give you. Second, you're going to get your second month free with them. Third, I know some of this is kind of new. You might not think of the possibilities of what you can do with this. They're going to give you two free one-on-one sessions with one of their platform consultants so that you talk to them, you learn, you go implement, and you can come back and have a follow-up call and say, here's what I'm doing. And finally, if you're using someone else's software, one that's a little too easy and you've outgrown it and you want to go something a little bit more powerful, you can actually get free migration. And that is only if you use this special URL. It is activecampaign.com/Mixergy, activecampaign.com/Mixergy to get that offer. And you're going to see, guys, this will really dramatically change your business and change the way you think about your potential and existing customers. All right. So let's talk about the goals because this thing was so exciting to me that I underlined it in my notes and I bolded it. Talk to me about what your goals were and how you made sure that you are aware of them.
So the initial goal or which goal in particular?
You know what? You're right. Let's go back to the first goal before we talk about the next three follow-up goals with where you want to be monthly, weekly, and daily for your sales. What was the original goal? How many subscribers?
Well, the original goal was the 1,000 subscribers, right?
Okay.
So we were like, okay, 1,000 subscribers for the year. So we launched Kickstarter in September 2015, and we finished up the Kickstarter in October. I think by February, we had 1,000 subscribers. So we were like, oh, okay, 1,000.
Because of the calls that you were making to existing customers?
No, that brought in like 350. Actually, the thing that like grew our business tremendously was, so during the Kickstarter campaign, there was a doctor, Chris Kresser, who is a paleo doctor and author and very well regarded in the paleo space, who tweeted about us and said, hey, here's a really interesting company, go check it out. And we just saw this flurry of signups happen from the tweet. And that was like, oh, huh, that's interesting. So we started reaching out to him as well as a whole bunch of other paleo influencers, as we call them, but people who have large email lists and large followings. And basically it was like, hey, we've noticed on this page or on this that you say you should be grass-fed beef. We're a grass-fed beef company. At that point, we also got into pasture-raised pork and chicken. But we'd love to, you know, basically set up a deal with you where you get a commission and you introduce people to our product. And that worked very well. So that we kind of unlocked that during Kickstarter. And then by January, it had our first promotion and had really started to grow.
I see.
So by February, we're like, okay, 1,000 wasn't too much, wasn't enough. 3,000? And then we blew through that, and we're like, 5,000? And it just continued to be like, I don't know, what can the goal be? So I had a sheet that I started that I thought was crazy, it's like right next to my desk, and it's basically... first $100,000 month, first $100,000 week, first $100,000 day, first $1 million month, first $1 million week, first $1 million day. And just put it up and was like, all right, let's see what this happened. People thought it was crazy. We've hit all of them except for the $1 million day, which will be ridiculous at some point.
Mike, when someone on your team would come to talk to you, when you sat down to work during the day, when a guest came to visit, all those situations, you were faced and they were faced with the goal of $10,000 a week, $100,000 a month, $100,000 a week, $100,000 a day, et cetera, $1 million a month. And so that would do what to you and the conversations you had with those people?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we do as a company is we have these huge goals, and then we set up these super lofty goals that nobody thinks is attainable. And then in this company, we've just blown through every single goal. I mean, we've been super aggressive, and we still blow through it. But what we do is I'm a very goal-oriented person. I do way better in my personal life and my business life if I have goals that I'm being driven towards. And as a company, we're all about the goals as well. So our goal for the year was to hit a subscriber total. And at the time, we had 6 people in our company. This was like last year. So last December when we were coming up with the goal. And it was like, oh, we got to do something crazy if we hit this goal. And I was like, you know what? If we hit this goal, we're going to go to Mexico. We now have 35 people, and we're all going to Mexico.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. But we said that was the prize, so I don't see how you walk it back.
That's fantastic. You know what? I noticed on your wrist that you have an orange wristband, and I've been wondering if that has something to do with goals, or what's the meaning of it?
Oh, this red one?
Yeah. Is it red? Okay.
It's red. It's for my CrossFit. I go to CrossFit. It's CrossFit Arsenal in Massachusetts. Awesome place. But this year I am 36 and I'm the year of a rooster, which is this year. And so my brother's like into Chinese history and stuff. And he has a Chinese New Year every year. And he's like, oh, this is your year. And I was like, oh yeah, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean for it to be your year? It's every 12 years is your year. And essentially it's a year where you are going to have profound transformative experience in your life. And it can be either good or bad, but it will be profound. And those that are superstitious wear red every day of the year. So I've been wearing this, and I have like a red thing in my car that I've done every day of the year. So
what do you mean by done? Just had something red on you every day of the year.
Other red one, this red rubber band, and then things got like better. So now. It's gonna turn into your microphone soon, I think.
Yeah, where I have all the beads, the meditation beads. In your personal life, what kind of goals do you set for yourself?
Oh man, I do this exercise every January where I come up with a massive list of goals. So I literally have, I don't know, there's probably 60 goals that I track on I should be doing it daily. I don't. I do it probably every week. But it's everything from spending time with my kids to how many times am I going to work out, how many times am I going to stretch, how many times am I going to meditate, how many times am I going to go on vacation, how many times am I going to go see my mother.
What's the one that you had to spend? How many times am I going to go see my mother? Some people would say, let that happen organically. Let your love for her dictate. No. Why? Why is it important to have that written down?
Well, so what I do, or, you know, the exercise is you do an inventory of your life and, like, what positions in your life do you think are important and which ones do you, you know, like, who's counting on you to do things or what brings me happiness? And, you know, I, like I said, I was youngest of four. Rest of my family's moved away. My mom always has, like, she's can't get the air conditioner out of her window, can't get her porch furniture off the porch, you know, small things.
I see. So as much as you love her, little things could come up in your life that would keep, and she, that would keep you from seeing her, and she might have all these different chores for you that you might start identifying her with the things that she needs done as opposed to what you want out of the relationship, and this holds you accountable.
Yeah, and also it just holds me accountable to, like, doing, if you set up your year, just like with a company, if you set up your quarter, or you set up your month, if you set up your year with, like, this is what I intend to do, and you're not going to hit everything, but if you set it up in a way that's like, this is what I want to do, this would be an amazing year, and then you hit 80% of that, it's pretty, it would be pretty remarkable. There's a guy online, Jack Daly, who posts his, he publishes his every year, and I mean, the guy's got crazy goals. He's like, marathons, 30 marathons this year, and like 4 Ironmans, and like all this craziness, but, yeah, I think it's, I don't know, I'm pretty crazy about goals.
What's been on your list over and over that's almost, like, frustrating to keep seeing because you don't hit it?
I have a weightlifting goal. I want to have a 300-pound squat and a 400-pound deadlift.
I see.
That's been a couple of years. So that one's been frustrating.
And so do you ever feel like, you know what, why do I keep trying for this? It's never happening.
Yeah, totally.
And you still put it on anyway.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know. Maybe this is, you know, like, so I have, we haven't gotten into this, but so in addition to the company, which has been growing leaps and bounds, and, you know, we've got 60 people now, and we're growing crazy, and that's been amazing. My family life has also boomed in the past year and a half. So I had one daughter, and then we were blessed with identical twin girls. So that's literally an egg splits. It's a 1 in 100 chance. So they're 14 months old. So there's a lot of, like, family stuff going on too. So when I look at my, like, my deadlift goal, I'm like, okay, I didn't hit it, but I don't know. Does that matter? Well, if you want to hit it, like, now's the time. You're not getting any younger. So it's a good reminder. You know, there's, you
and
can
your
never
wife's on board with it. She says, you know what? My husband has this goal. We have kids. I need him to help with the kids, but this goal, weightlifting goal, working out goal is important to him, and it's important to us.
Well, she wants me to help out with the kids for longer than, you
know? I remember I was trying to run more. The thing that helped me was just saying to my wife, I need your help to get me to run more. So it wasn't now me trying to squeeze more time for myself out of our relationship. It was her helping me and us working together. You know, you and I met through Dan. How do you pronounce his last name? Latour?
Yeah.
He's your partnership guy. What kind of partnerships could ButcherBox need?
So, I mean, there are lots of potential partnerships. One of the big ones is we talk with a lot of, so I talked about the paleo doctors, but there are lots of people, grass-fed beef or eating clean meat is not necessarily something that the mainstream finds to be important, which is why 98% of the beef consumed in the United States is a feedlot cow. And there are lots of people who have a voice and with their audience, and their audience, like, you know, listens to them and says, oh yeah, like whatever he says, I'm into, or whatever she says, I do. So people who can help spread our message and spread our message of clean meat, spread our message of how good it is for the environment, or how much better it is for the environment, humane treatment of animals, all that stuff, which is really important to us. That's great. And then there are a lot of companies, whether it's kitchen equipment or cooking companies, that just have the ear of people, like you were saying, with the taste side. So, like, way better taste, and they're helping to promote us as well. And then, I mean, I just love chatting about entrepreneurship. I love talking about, I love coaching entrepreneurs on why not to take venture capital and to try to do it yourself, because I think there's a big...
I feel like you'd be a good coach. That right now, I think you'd be a phenomenal coach. I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of people reached out to you and just found a way to get to Boston just to learn from you. The goal setting part that you did, the achievement that you did in a topic that in a product that most people wouldn't think could scale this much would draw people to you. I get it. What I'm wondering is, when he does these partnerships, and I'm looking at some of like the things that send you traffic, is it like as affiliates? I'm trying to understand how you get these customers. Now that I get where the business is and how big it's gotten, I'm trying to get where you get the customers. So what kind of partnerships lead? Is it affiliates? Is it just getting people to write articles about you? Is it a combination of both?
Yeah, so I mean, it actually came out of the fact that we didn't raise money. So when we started the company, we didn't raise any money because I didn't want to go and do the $28 million thing. I wanted to do it for 10 grand in a Kickstarter campaign. And so when we were thinking about how to market ourselves, we couldn't do like, let's go burn a bunch of money on Facebook and hope for the best. And so what we ended up doing was reaching out to some of these influencers or people that have their audiences, and we paid them what's like a ongoing royalty, I guess is how you could call it, but essentially an ongoing payment for every month that the customer stays.
I see. So I read some of that. So there was Business Insider did a piece on you. They very clearly at the top said, this is something that we get paid for, but they did a real good job explaining it. I mean, the writer said, I bought it. I took it home. I don't have a grill at home. I guess he's a New Yorker. Borrowed one from a friend, grilled it, showed pictures of it, talked about how he just added like salt and pepper to it and what it tasted like. And then if you wanted it, there was a link. By the way, the link is broken. You guys might want to get on it and tell them to fix the link. But that's the kind of thing we're talking about. I see that Whole30 wrote about you guys, Whole30.com. PaleyOMG.com wrote about you, a bunch of different sites. Those are partnerships that he would do, and that's part of what drives you business. You have this mission. There's a bunch of people who have this worldview or a similar worldview that can buy into your religion of grass-fed, healthy meat. You go expose them to your product. Sometimes it's just for writing articles. Sometimes it's an affiliate commission. That's a part of your the way that you get customers. What else do you do? What beyond the partnerships, tell me more about what you do to get to blow through your sales figures.
Yeah, so we've started doing a whole bunch of other avenues and trying to find other gushers, if you will. So other places where it's just like, wow, this is working really well. We're doing a lot of content. We're doing Facebook and Google, and we do a lot of emails. So we have a big email list for people who might have been a customer or might have almost been a customer but fell off. And we're just, you know, partnership, like whatever we can do. We've just started doing, it's actually been pretty successful, is gift boxes. So lots of people have reached out to us saying, hey, I have 10 people I want to send a gift to. We've been doing that, which has been working really well.
Meaning like the holidays are coming up. I don't want to give people another fruit basket. We're much more of a meat eater type of community. I'm going to send them meat. Got it. Okay. Exactly. Basically, you're starting to get into the Omaha steak part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, Omaha Steaks is a $700 million business, and they're basically a gift business.
So they do the annual sales.
Yeah, they do the majority of their business in the last 2 months of the year, and so people just get tons of gifts. And you know, I mean, there's a time and a place for Omaha Steaks. I think Omaha Steaks is kind of, in terms of its positioning and like the meat it's providing, it's just not what. A lot of people are looking for.
Also feel like it's a little too mainstream to feel like a good gift. It's the kind of thing that people would have had as a gift maybe from their uncle years ago, or there's a 10, 20 year history there that people have connections with. It doesn't feel like the special new thing that you're introduced to. All right, let me talk about one challenging thing that you did, and then I will also analyze some of the things that I've seen that one challenging campaign that you did to get customers, and then I'll analyze using similarweb.com, frankly, and what I've seen on your site, some of the things that you did to get customers, and then we'll close it out. But I want to understand how you got to this number. One thing that you did, I'm on Kickstarter. There's something called free bacon exclamation point, free period, bacon period, lots of different material on it. I do not even enjoy eating bacon. My mouth, look, you can actually see, is literally watering from this freaking picture of bacon that you have on your screen. This was a campaign. Describe what the campaign was and how it did for you as a business.
Yeah. So bacon has like literally just grown this business. I mean, that's our secret, bacon. So When we started,
what do you mean your secret is bacon? I thought it was cows, not pigs.
Well, we actually moved even before the Kickstarter because we did a bunch of research. Nobody wanted 8 pounds of beef a month delivered to their door. It just seemed like a much smaller concept than having pork and chicken as well, or any variety of those three. So even when we launched Kickstarter, our positioning was all about grass-fed beef, but we were grass-fed beef, pork, chicken as well. And okay. one of the tricks for running a great Kickstarter campaign is you want to do something where you can get your audience really fired, like your current people who have already backed you really fired up about sharing you and whatnot. And what we did was we had a stretch goal prize of $150,000. If we hit $150,000, everyone got free bacon in their box. People just went nuts. I mean, like sharing everywhere, like, you know, just very excited about the fact that they were going to get free bacon, and then we're just thrilled that they hit it. And so when we started, from a technical standpoint, everyone got bacon in their first box. At the same time, we had all these new subscribers joining, and the new subscribers, we found out like 3 weeks into it, were actually also getting bacon, because we didn't like separate the first box that got shipped and whether it was a new subscriber versus a Kickstarter person.
So
instead of turning off the bacon, we were like, oh, this is definitely a feature, not a bug. So we basically just started selling, sign up and get free bacon in your first box. The only reason was because we didn't know how to shut it off. And it was going over so well. People were like, oh, wow, I didn't know I was going to get this bacon. I'm really excited about the bacon. So the reason why I say it grew us tremendously is one of the biggest promotions that we've ever done was this summer. It was Bacon
July Day. July 13th, Butcher yeah. Box Bacon Day.
Bacon Day, where we did bacon for life, which means if you sign up, we will put bacon in your box, every single box that you get for the rest of your subscription. It worked incredibly well. We had tons and tons of signups. It was kind of the first time that we broke our systems. Bacon has continued to be...
Broke your systems, meaning customer support couldn't handle it. Broke your systems, meaning it took 2 weeks to respond to people's questions. Broke your system, meaning the most subscriptions you... Okay, I'm going to give you your numbers. You're okay with that, right? I told you before we started that I wasn't going to reveal anything, but once you revealed it, I'm not editing it out. So with your permission, I'm going to say, before that, the most you ever sold in a single month was 6,000 subscriptions. Bacon Day led to 7,000 subscriptions in 3 days.
Yep.
That is breaking records. And then it also broke customer service. You had Stripe on your phone, which anyone who sells knows what's about to happen. Your phone would vibrate whenever you got a sale. You used to do a drinking game with that. What was a drinking game around that?
Yeah, no, we did a drinking game that day, which was because everyone was like, I mean, we were just like, oh my God, this is so cool. But basically that phone was going off so often. So we were playing like hot potato with the phone, and you just pass the phone and then it would go off and the person would have to drink. And it was just like, I mean, it went off like 1500 times in a business day. So we had to stop because it was a little too much.
Okay. All right. Here's what I see that you guys do when I'm on your site. Number one, you use pop-ups with a discount offer to collect email addresses, which is what allows you to grow your mailing list. Am I right? Number one, that's one thing I saw. Number two, I see you guys do a considerable amount of paid ad buys. So obviously you buy the word butcher box, but you also buy phrases like buy meat online and grass-fed meat online, et cetera, right?
Yep.
You also do quite a bit with, strangely, on Instagram, though I haven't seen your Instagram account, and on YouTube, where it kind of makes sense, right? So you're using social media. You have someone internally who's in charge of this?
Yeah. We do. And then we do a lot of Facebook advertising as well.
Buying Facebook ads.
Biggest lever that we've been pulling recently.
And it seems to me like at this point, let me see. At this point, YouTube is really polished, but hasn't kicked off a lot of customers. It does seem to send you traffic, right?
YouTube is like just beginning.
Yeah. It's not unusual for you guys to have... My mouth is literally watering. That's what I was doing there. Literally watering as I look at these pictures. The YouTube channel has a few dozen videos. It's not unusual for a video to have just like 2 or 3 dozen views, though there is potential in that I see from similar web traffic coming in. All right. I think I've analyzed everything for you here. No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say that I believe a really big opportunity for us is to be a content creator. So what we've been doing to date is leveraging people that have existing networks and a voice in whether it's a chef or a doctor saying, this is great, you should eat this. What we want to do is start to have ourselves be part of that conversation. So I think look out for a lot more content, and we're really dialing in both what our customer needs in order to be able to be empowered to cook the piece that or the piece of meat that we send them, as well as what do potential customers need in terms of, you know, how to cook a ribeye or how to sear a steak or how to roast a chicken or any of this other stuff that we're producing. We're actually building out a test kitchen, which is going to be online in like a month, where we'll just be able to crank through recipes and content
Makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense. And now I asked you where, before we started, I asked you where you were, and you were just like hunting all around your office. So I got a sense of what the place looked like. Looking for the right Wi-Fi. And you said, hey, you know what? It turns out this place that we got for office space has really nice window views. And so we're going to start selling beef at retail. All right.
Well, we're actually not selling the product. We're just talking to people about
it. Oh, I see. Okay.
But yeah, it's a great window line. It's like a billboard in Harvard Square, which is where our office is. So we had to try the retail thing.
You never know where this stuff is going to go. Warby Parker, I remember interviewing the founder. They just had people come into their office space to try on glasses to get a sense of what their customers were like. In their office, they were selling glasses. They realized this thing is actually more powerful than we expected. Let's open up a bunch of retail stores. You're smiling. It sounds like you've got some recognition there. You don't know where it's going to go.
Yeah, we, you know, this was like an office play that's turned into a retail play. And then, you know, I'm a big believer in, you know, the red balloon, and just you gotta make sure you grab onto the right opportunities. And not everything is a good opportunity, but, you know, just try to limit the downside and hop on the opportunities you can.
All right. Look at this. Even one of your pieces of content is introducing the ButcherBox Kickstarter playbook. So you're going to teach people what you learned about doing Kickstarter to launch a business. All right. I'm going to close it out with one final question. I see the number here. I don't want to reveal it if you're not open to it. But remember, I said, once you reveal it, I'm not editing it out. I only say that because guests keep telling me, Andrew, edit this part out. Take that part out. Annual revenue. Where are you guys now?
We will be north of, annual revenue is what do I want to say? We're in the tens of millions.
Yeah, and by tens of millions, he doesn't mean like a low tens of millions. He's kind of BSing you. It's really considerable revenue. Sometimes people will like say six figures, but they include the stuff after the decimal point. All right. Congratulations on getting this far. I keep thinking back to the beginning of your story, the guy who sold t-shirts, who sold the Boston t-shirt, the guy who used to take newspapers. Man, your mom must be so proud that you worked you. They got your ass out of the house and got you to go do stuff because look at how far you freaking come. The website for anyone who wants to go check it out is butcherbox.com, butcherbox.com. And the two sponsors who I mentioned, the first one helps us close more sales and get more guests here for Mixergy interviews. It's called Pipe Drive. Drive more sales. Go to pipedrive.com/Mixergy. And the second, even if you don't sign up for them, I urge you to go check out their webpage because they have a couple of good images that will show you how marketing automation really can change your business. Just a couple of really well done animations. I mean, images. Go to activecampaign.com/Mixergy. Scroll about halfway down the page and you'll see what I'm talking about. activecampaign.com/Mixergy. I'm grateful to them. And guys, as always, my team is trying to figure out how well they're doing with audio. So keep sending us feedback. contact@mixergy.com. Ari is specifically trying to improve the audio of the interview. So let us know. Mike, thanks so much for doing this interview.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I could just put in a plug, if anyone does want to reach out to me, they can write to CEO@butcherbox.com.
CEO@butcherbox.com. All right, cool. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Bye. Bye, everyone.